Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. About 30 million people who've lost their jobs are now in limbo after the additional $600 a week in unemployment benefits expired. Many are worried about how they will pay their rent and feed their families. House Democrats passed a bill more than 2 months ago that would expand that $600 in weekly unemployment benefits through the end of the year. It is part of a $3 trillion bill that would also provide funding to frontline workers, the healthcare industry, schools, and state and local governments. Senate Republicans released a plan to reduce the amount from $600 to $200 a week through September, and then cap federal jobless assistance to 70% of workers' pay. Republicans also want immunity for corporations, which would make it impossible for people to hold corporations accountable for cutting corners on safety precautions. Republicans also want even more money for weapons, including $2 billion for F-35s, although that part of the budget has not gotten as much media attention. Meantime, 26 million adults say they do not have enough to eat, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. 13 million renters are behind on their rent. 28 million people risk eviction, according to Princeton's Eviction Lab. So the real question here is, what will it take to push Republicans to extend benefits before even more people fall into deep poverty and possibly even become homeless? Terry O'Lee is California campaign director for the Economic Security Project, an advocacy group building economic power for all. Terry has worked as an attorney with the California Public Interest Research Group, and she joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Terry. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks, Rose. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Melissa Cannon is senior advocate at California Food Policy Advocates, a nonprofit focusing on food policy and increasing low-income Californians' access to healthy food. And Melissa joins us from Oakland. Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. If we can just get to the real question here, it really does boil down to Republicans and their plan. What will it take to force them to agree to extend the $600 in weekly benefits before people, you know, lose their homes and fall into deep poverty? Terry, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, let's get right to it. Well, I think you raise a really good question, and I think that the answer is that the public is wildly supportive of the government stepping in and supporting people during this crisis. That, to me, is a big disconnect between what people on the ground, constituents, voters, just people, believe needs to happen and those in Congress that are blocking moving forward with this.
Right. What would you add, Melissa?
I think we also need our House leaders to continue to step up and fight this fight. Nancy Pelosi was instrumental in the last recession when we had similar challenges with families who were struggling. And she stood up then and fought for our CalFresh benefits for families who need that extra assistance. And we need to make sure that our leaders, not just on the Republican side, are also fighting for these benefits and help that Californians so desperately need.
Yeah, to that point, what else do you think Democrats should be doing right now, Melissa?
I think they need to continue to lift up the need for all of these supports that are missing from the Senate GOP's proposal. Absolutely, we need to make sure that our unemployment benefits are not cut. We have millions of Californians who are out of work, and the problem's not going away. But we also have millions of Californians who are facing other hardships. You know, their kids can't go to school. They're struggling to find affordable childcare or afford childcare at all. And we have families who are lining up outside of food banks, lining up outside of schools to get any kind of help putting food on the table. And we're facing a hunger crisis throughout the United States. And so we need House leaders to stand up for a boost to SNAP benefit so that families have help with putting food on the table. We need our leaders to stand up for other forms of food assistance, like pandemic EBT for families who have lost out on school meals. There's a lot of additional nutrition supports that were completely missing from the Senate Republicans' proposal, but were part of the House leaders' proposal back in May. And we need to make sure that our House leaders are continuing to fight that fight for those additional benefits as well. We've seen countless times as each recovery package has been put forth that a boost to SNAP benefits is one of the first things to be dropped. And we just can't let that happen again. We have too many people who are suffering right now. Mm.
Terry, what would you add at this point? What would you like to see from Democrats?
Yeah, I agree with Melissa. This is an opportunity for the Democrats to continue to lead. I agree with the HEROES Act, the CARES Act, and then the HEROES Act. They created a wide range of supports. And I do want to lift up the CAS payments. That is one, that is what our organization is pushing for, is recurring CAS. In addition to unemployment, in addition to SNAP, in addition to other supports, because it is so useful, and so many people are facing a crisis right now, but everyone's crisis is a little bit different, and so CAS gives people the flexibility to address their whatever needs they're having, whether that's food, whether that's housing, whether that's childcare, whether that's small businesses who need to continue to support their business so that it doesn't, that it doesn't go under during this time. So I think that the Democrats, that's what we're calling on Congress to do, both Democrats and Republicans, to extend this set of supports, but also to make the cash payments recurring. The one-time cash was extremely helpful, but was spent extremely quickly. Many households spent it within a couple of weeks on basic necessities. And, that was before May. That was before the HEROES Act passed. That was the one-time payment in the CARES Act. So we know that people are really hurting and need ongoing support through this crisis.
Well, I want to give out the phone number. If anyone would like to call in, if you'd like to call in and share your story, how are you going to pay the bills without that extra $600 in weekly unemployment benefits? If you have any story to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I mean, it's really hard to wrap your head around these numbers, but everybody has a story here. 26 million people saying they don't have enough to eat. 28 million people risk eviction. We did a show about evictions a couple of weeks ago, and I've seen video on social media of these eviction courts that are packed, and activists are actually preventing people from walking into the court so people don't lose their homes. They have nowhere to go. So what are your thoughts about where we are right now? And again, to be real, the question here is, what will it take to push the GOP to extend these benefits before people lose their homes and fall into deep poverty? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Melissa, it's also really important to point out that even before COVID hit, 40% of Americans were living paycheck to paycheck. They were unable to afford an emergency $400 expense. That got a lot of attention. So people were really struggling before the pandemic, and now it's just making it even worse.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had long challenges with families facing poverty, and the crisis is only exacerbating those existing inequities. When we look at rates of families who are struggling to put food on the table, families who are facing hunger, disproportionately our Black and Latino families are being hit the hardest. That has historically been the case, but it's just getting worse. Back in July, our Black adults across California were two times more likely than white adults to live in households that were struggling with food insufficiency. And in that same time period, Latino adults were almost three times more likely than white adults to have those struggles with putting food on the table. And we know that Congress has continued to pass pieces of legislation that leave behind our immigrant families. These are our friends and neighbors who work here, who are oftentimes lawfully present, who are continuing to be left behind. So we're seeing existing struggles exacerbated even further.
I think it's so important to talk about undocumented immigrants, because undocumented immigrants, and we've done a lot of shows about COVID outbreaks on farms and meat processing plants. They have not had access to any unemployment benefits. Here in California, they had access to a one-time $500 check. And when the system opened, the phone lines were so full that people couldn't even get in. So it's so important, Terry, to really talk also about how undocumented immigrants are really struggling through all of this.
Yes. I mean, I think it is unconscionable that policies that have been created over the last couple of months to support people have not been inclusive and have excluded, by design, immigrant households, mixed status households, often where the children are themselves or some members of the family are actually citizens, but because someone in the family is not, the entire family is excluded. And it's unconscionable. And you're right, it has created, it has exacerbated the disparities that already existed. And I think the one thing that comes out of that that might be hopeful for the future is that it was impossible to ignore. I think before this crisis hit, obviously there's been a tremendous amount of incredible advocacy and grassroots work being done to include all members of our communities and our society here in California and across the country, especially with things like tax credits, like extending the Cali ITC to ITIN filers, extending the Young Child Tax Credit to ITIN filers. It's been a big campaign to do that. But when this crisis hit, it just couldn't be ignored. You know, it was like the bottom fell out, you know, for households of immigrants, where you couldn't get unemployment insurance, you couldn't get, you know, all the tax credits and things you're already excluded from, and then also couldn't get the direct cash payments either. Those $1,200 payments, people were excluded if they filed with an ITIN. So it really brought into, I think, just stark relief how poorly and how much we discriminate against households with immigrants. And I was glad to see that the HEROES Act that the House passed in May does include ITINs, and that is excellent, and more of that needs to be done. And I think there's actually a little bit of hope. There are some Republican senators who have called for including ITINs, mixed status families, and that is a step in the right direction. But I agree, it has created more disparity and more hardship, and it boggles the mind how households are struggling.
Did you say ITINs? ITINs? What
yeah,
is that?
Sorry, I'm using a term of art there. So if you file taxes, and here's the thing that just makes this all the worse. So many immigrants that do not have social security numbers are actually filing taxes with an identification number. So it's a tax ID. It's called an individual tax identification number. So ITIN for short. And it means you're filing taxes with an ITIN. You're telling the IRS how much money you've made. You're paying taxes, and yet you are excluded from tax credits. You're excluded from those economic impact payments. You're excluded from unemployment insurance. So here are people working, contributing, paying taxes, and are kept out of all of the supports that Social Security number holders get. Mm.
Well, we should also say that if you live in California, state legislators are working on a plan to extend the $600 payments. This would be part of a $100 billion stimulus plan. And if this does go through, they also want to extend those payments to undocumented immigrants who have lost their jobs. The plan would also protect renters from eviction and give support to homeowners and landlords who are having a hard time paying their bills. So, I was listening to Gavin Newsom's press conference yesterday, and he was asked about a piece of legislation that would tax people making more than $1 million a year. He never really answered the question directly. He just said that, you know, I'm not going to opine about legislation. So there's that legislation, and then the legislators are working to extend the $600. So hopefully something will come down soon. If you have any stories to share about you know, if you were on unemployment and now you're not going to get that $600 in federal unemployment benefits, how are you going to make ends meet? Because the maximum in a state like California is $450 a week. It depends on what you made beforehand. But in other states, it could go as low as $150 a week. So that's what some people are going to get now, $150 a week without that $600. And, you know, we don't know when a plan with the Republicans is going to kick in. And even if it does, it will take weeks for people to see that additional money. And with COVID surging, there are just no jobs. People cannot go back to their jobs. So what are your thoughts on this? If you'd like to share a story, overall thoughts, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Terry Oley is California Campaign Director for the Economic Security Project. Melissa Cannon is Senior Advocate at California Food Policy Advocates. I want to ask you both about this line that the Republicans are pushing. We should say that, you know, these are the same Republicans that passed the $2 trillion tax cut. 85% went to the top 1% 2 years ago. These same Republicans are saying that the $600 in weekly unemployment benefits discourages people from going back to work. A new study from Yale says that is not the case. In fact, when jobs that pay even less are available again, people are going back to work. So, Terry, can you comment on this since it's getting so much attention in the media?
Yes. And I wanted to point out, too, that you were talking before about, you know, what your unemployment benefits might drop to once the $600 goes away. But I think it's also really important to note that that's assuming you can get unemployment insurance at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we've seen, there's been some reports out in the last couple of weeks that show that actually of the, you know, 70 odd million people who adults who were not working, like they kind of look at it in the last week, something like only about 20 million are actually getting unemployment benefits. So there is, and the disparity there is pretty astonishing. Black workers are actually much less likely to have access to unemployment insurance than white workers. So already.
And why is that?
Yeah, well, some of the things that you mentioned. So the state programs, you know, really depending on how the state programs are run, they're overwhelmed, for one. So right. We've certainly seen that in California, that the programs are overrun and there's not enough staff. And so the clunky process of getting unemployment takes too much time and people get dissuaded and discouraged. There is also a lot of review and denial that may not be appropriate. And so, you know, that's built into the system. And then to be honest, some of the states have created unemployment insurance programs by design that are very discouraging and set up a whole set of obstacles that just make it hard to get unemployment insurance. And so people either are blocked by those obstacles or they know they exist and in some cases don't even try. So we know that the scope of the unemployment benefits is not even covering the people that should be getting them. So I think that is something to really hold out as important, and also another reason why, again, our organization is really pushing for those recurring direct cash payments that are just those $1,200, send them to people, they can use them for whatever they need, and that really fills in the gaps when people are not able to get the benefits that they should be able to get but are not.
And to that point, just quickly, Terry, there was a piece in the Chronicle about the San Francisco Chronicle about how difficult it has been for people to get their benefits. In the LA Times, they interviewed a person who calls 100 times a day. They report that the EDD in California has a 4 to 6 week wait time for workers to call back customers. A couple of the tips: contact your state senator and your assembly member. Their staff will collect your information and they'll reach out to the EDD on your behalf. The other tip is that the EDD does not have caller ID. So if you're expecting an EDD call, answer a call from a blocked number because you won't know that it's the EDD, and then who knows when they'll call you back. So those are just a couple of tips.
Yeah, it has been astonishing to read the stories of people trying to get unemployment And it, I think this is, you know, playing out all over the country. I think it's really bringing to light. And I know, Melissa, that I used to work with CFPA a fair bit on food security issues. And I know Melissa's organization works a lot on CalFresh and making sure CalFresh, you know, the food stamp benefits are accessible. And, you know, the CalFresh system, the unemployment insurance system, these are all, you know, systems that in some cases the computer systems themselves are outdated and the programs are outdated, and there's just so there's like sort of the human requirement of having to process all of these applications, but also our technology is not where it needs to be as a state, and that is another thing that it just cannot flex in the way that it needs to accommodate the incredible demand right now. So yeah, I think the we are really seeing a lot of sort of cracks in our infrastructure, in our certainly our technology infrastructure and our service delivery infrastructure. And those are things that are going to need to be remedied. They need to be remedied now. But as you mentioned at the top of the hour, you know, with the state facing, it's, you know, we're going to be facing our own economic crisis here, with in terms of budget. It's going to be hard to, you know, allocate money to service delivery, but we're going to, that's why we need to do something to support people during this time, because these systems are really collapsing under the weight.
I would just add that, you know, it's not sexy to invest in these systems and infrastructure. And so we often have state government officials who just aren't willing to fight for these major changes that we need that enable people to get access to the benefits that they need and to get access to those benefits quickly. We led a bill this last year and a whole state budget campaign to streamline access to CalFresh for older adults. And we're still waiting on the state to step up and help make sure that we can implement all of the flexibilities that we have to enable individuals to get as quick as access to these programs as they can. And I don't want to discount the amazing work that has happened within California and with the CalFresh program to date. It's so much easier to get enrolled in benefits now. And with a lot of the flexibilities that the United States Department of Agriculture has put in place, we can have CalFresh workers really streamlining access to benefits for families. But we need those flexibilities to continue as well. So it's, again, it's not sexy, but there's a real opportunity for state leaders to help get access to these benefits and to give quick access to the resources and supports that Californians need to get through this crisis.
What about benefits at the federal level? The Families First Act included SNAP benefits. The USDA increased the monthly benefit by 40%. The bill also included pandemic EBT, which compensated families who lost access to free and reduced price meals when schools closed. Melissa, can you give us an update on those benefits?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to note is a lot of these benefits are going to expire unless Congress takes action. We saw an amazing program get implemented across the United States called Pandemic EBT, which is designed to help families who've lost access to school meals, to help give them some benefits to purchase groceries to care for their kids while their kids are at home. And we've enrolled over 3.5 million California children onto that program in just a short period of time. It was a huge lift that's rolled out a huge amount of benefits to families and has helped. We've seen research shown that it's actually reduced the levels of food insecurity in the state. But that program, it's essentially done. The application deadline has closed, and California can't implement it again unless Congress steps up and authorizes USDA and provides the funds to extend it into the next school year. So that's one critical program that's rolled out, helped millions of kids, and it's not going to be able to continue that support unless Congress takes action. And in addition to pandemic EBT, we're going to see some flexibilities that are local WIC agencies who provide benefits through the Women, Infants, and Children's Program. There are some flexibilities that Congress has put in place to enable our WIC agencies to serve families remotely so that they don't have to go into the clinic to get enrolled into the program. So families have been enrolled remotely, getting access to benefits while staying safe, secure, and isolating at home. And that's going to expire unless Congress authorizes the continuation of those flexibilities throughout the entire pandemic. There are a number of additional flexibilities that are just needed to serve access to school meals. And some of these opportunities, like being able to serve meals to kids of all ages in schools, actually don't require congressional action. USDA has authority, but they're not acting on it. There have been hundreds of school nutrition leaders who have stepped up and are calling on the United States Department of Agriculture to get rid of these hurdles and just allow them to do what they want to do, which is feed kids who are in need. And thankfully, we have senators like Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's also reached out to USDA, and we're waiting on USDA to take action. There are a lot of flexibilities that we need built into these programs in order to make sure that they're meeting the needs of families during the pandemic.
We're going to take a quick break. Melissa Cannon is Senior Advocate at California Food Policy Advocates. Terry O'Lee is California Campaign Director for the Economic Security Project. And today we are talking about what it will take to push the GOP to extend benefits before even more people fall into deep poverty and become homeless. After the break, we'll be joined by Sheila Ritter. Sheila was laid off from her job as a security guard at the Pepsi Center in Denver, Colorado, and she recently told CNBC that she is having a very hard time making ends meet and putting enough food on the table. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a story to share or you'd like to just talk about where we are right now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We got a tweet from a listener who says, I hope the $600 payment returns soon because I don't expect to find a job at my age and in my industry anytime besides a low paying gig job. Thank you for that tweet. If you'd like to tweet us, it's at Your Call Radio. Now I would like to welcome Sheila Ritter to the show. Sheila was laid off from her job working security at the Pepsi Center in Denver. And I want to thank CNBC because that's how we found Sheila. She shared her story about struggling to make ends meet and buying enough food for her and her son. Hi, Sheila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Well, we're hanging in there. How are you doing? You lost your job in security at the Pepsi Center, and I understand that since then you had to move out of your apartment in Denver and you ended up buying an RV because the rents are just too high.
Yeah, and the with me not having a job since March, you know, trying to find an apartment to move in was impossible. You know, you have to have first and last month's rent, and then you have to have your deposit, and I have a dog, so I'd have to have the pet deposit. You know, it was like $2,000 that I could not come up with, and that was the cheapest place I could find. Wow. And with not having a verifiable form of income, they don't want to put you into an apartment with no guarantee that you can make the next month's rent.
Well, and also, I'm sorry to hear that your husband passed away 2.5 years ago. And after he passed, you approached your landlord, told your landlord about it, the apartment manager, and she said, when are you moving out?
Yeah. She was just very, very heartless. It was like 2 days after he passed away. I went into her office and I sat in front of her desk and I said, you know, my husband passed away at home. And she's like, well, when are you leaving? And I'm like, as soon as our lease is up. She's like, oh, good, because you probably couldn't afford to stay here anyway. Didn't even ask if I had a job, didn't even ask if I could afford the rent. I mean, nothing. She was just like, it's time for you to leave. Okay. And I had no clue where we were going to go. I mean, I figured then we were going to be homeless because at the time I hadn't worked in 15 years. And, you know, so trying to get back in the job force after 15 years was amazingly hard.
Yeah, what was that like?
Well, considering I had basically no skills for 15 years except homemaking and taking care of kids, I ended up, a friend of mine had a business where he was giving direction to people who had nursing experience. And since I was a mother, of course, I had some nursing experience. And so I got a job working with him with a lady who had had a stroke. And basically, I was just basically her housekeeper and making sure she took her pills. So it was okay for a first job of not working for 15 years.
And then you eventually got a job at the Pepsi Center in Denver working security. No health benefits, no time off. You were part-time seasonal, making $11.75 an hour?
Yeah. Yeah, it was the best I could come up with at the time. And, you know, with my age, I'm 51 years old now. And so with my age, and I don't care what anybody says, there is ageism in workforce hiring because it's hard to get a job when you're 50 and older.
Right.
Especially when you don't have any real skill.
Like so many of these massive stadiums, Sheila, that are highly profitable, they tend to outsource a lot of the work. So in your case, they outsource security to Argus. And when you got laid off because of COVID, you got $100?
Yeah, and I think, I don't even know if that was just like a bonus or if that's just what they had or whatever. But yeah, it was for a lot of us that worked for that company, it was kind of a slap in the face because some of us have, you know, we gave up our houses, I mean, our families and spending time with our kids on their birthdays to go to work. And we love our job. Don't get me wrong. It's a really excellent job. But to have this kind of a situation and then have the company go, well, here's $100. Hope it gets you some food. You know, so it was appalling. It really was for me. And to know that, you know, they bring in millions of dollars each venue for the owners of the companies and the benefactors, the owners of the facilities, that kind of gets to you. I mean, we pay these people a lot of money to play a sport or to own a sporting company, and we basically are just dropped to the side like a used tissue.
Wow. And Sheila, before the show, we were talking about the fact that a beer costs more than what you make in an hour at the Pepsi Center.
Yeah, a beer over there at the Pepsi Center is like $15. That would have been one person's 1 hour or less payment. I mean, yeah, they had like a couple of hundred people that were working for the concession stands. But you figure a couple hundred beers per hour, thousands of beers per hour for a couple of hours, and that's paying your money right there.
But has your boss or anyone at the Pepsi Center been in touch with you to find out how things are going and to give you any updates?
Argus has. The bosses with Argus have been excellent at keeping in contact with us and letting us know what's going on. And kind of right now, we're kind of all up in the air because, you know, we don't know when we're going back to work. We don't know when they're going to be having venues that are going to be accepting more than 150 people. I mean, we had a venue that at Red Rocks that was open like last week, and we had maybe a handful of security officers that were working out there because it was 175 people.
Hmm. So, Sheila, you told CNBC that you're having a hard time even putting enough food on the table for you and your son.
Yeah, it's been a struggle. I mean, my son is a type 1 diabetic, and so he is supposed to eat frequently small meals, and trying to get one or two meals a day it's really hard. I mean, when you have to either get something to eat or put gas in the vehicle in order to go get something to eat, you know, it's kind of a, what do we do? Mm. I mean, we depend a lot on family and friends and stuff like that, but even they're having to say, you know, I don't have it because I haven't worked since whenever, and so we're all basically in the same boat. It's only going to get worse.
Mm. Well, and now you're not getting that extra $600 a month, so how is that going to affect you?
That's going to hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been trying to figure out how I'm going to come up with, like car payments and stuff like that. I mean, right now I'm living in an RV because we don't have rent money. And I'm having to pay my
the person who loaned me the money to get the RV, and that's taking quite a bit of chunk of change. So that $600 a month, it was paying about half of what I owed this guy for the RV. And I'm like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I can pay you a little bit, but, you know, I've got to survive too. He's like, no worry, just pay me what you can.
Sheila, how are you going to plan for the next couple months?
The planning. Yeah. Well, considering Colorado, we have to look for jobs. Even in COVID situation, we have to be actively looking for a job to get on to stay on unemployment. And, I mean, yeah, there are jobs out there, but they're not paying enough. I mean, if you're making minimum wage working flipping hamburgers for 2 days a week, that's not going to pay for your food. That's not going to pay your bills. So, you know, even though people say, oh, there's plenty of jobs out there, there's 35 million people out of work right now.
Yeah.
Dude, they don't have that many jobs right now.
Right.
So, you know, one of my friends the other day, she says, I make more money on unemployment, but I want to go to work. Mm. A lot of us are like that.
Yeah.
I really want to go back to work. But, you know, with COVID, I'm scared to go back to work.
See, that's it right there. Right.
Yeah.
You have, you know, people like Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, saying that it discourages people from going back to work. But people are afraid to go back to work for obvious reasons.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the only surviving parent of a child who needs medical care pretty much 24 hours a day. And I'm going to go back to work, bring COVID back to him, get him sick, put him in the hospital, or worse yet, put me in the hospital. Who's going to take care of my son, who is homeless, basically,
right,
while I'm in the hospital?
Well, Sheila, you know, I'm again, thanks to CNBC, and I'm so glad that I found you online. Thank you for joining us and sharing your story. And I don't even know what to say. I mean, we'll be thinking about you. We'd love to have you back. And we're just going to keep doing shows about this and, you know, figure out what it's going to take for the Republicans to agree to a plan. So, you know, that $600 will be sent again.
They have definitely got to get it together. They have got to figure out that people like us who need that money are going to die without it. And I know that sounds melodramatic, but it's true. I mean, if my son doesn't get his medication, he will die. If he doesn't eat frequently or if he doesn't eat the proper amount of food, he will die. And I really don't think they want me up there. just saying.
Sheila, thank you. And I know that your son's there listening. Thank you to your son. And we'll be thinking of you and him. And we'll have you back soon to check in again.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. All the prayers would be welcome because we can use all the help we can get.
Well, we're sending them. Thank you so much. That is Sheila Ritter. She worked security at the Pepsi Center in Denver, Colorado, making $11.75 an hour. She lost her job in March. She got $100 from the security company that works the venues, and now she's losing that extra $600 in unemployment benefits. Her husband passed 2.5 years ago, so she wasn't able to come up with the $1,400 a month in apartment rent. So she and her son now live in an RV, and they're staying on the lawn in front of a friend's home. There are so many stories like this across the country. And if you have a story that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Melissa Cannon is senior advocate at California Food Policy Advocates. Terry Oley is California campaign director for the Economic Security Project. Terry, any thoughts about Sheila's story? There are so many like her.
Yeah, that was, it's hard to hear. And we know that Sheila is one of millions of people who are facing these types of just untenable, dire circumstances. I, over the last few weeks, have been organizing small business owners in a variety of states and districts around the country, and have been talking directly to small business owners. And the stories have been, much like Sheila's, absolutely heartbreaking. people who have not been able to get the small business loans or very small businesses. You know, we technically define a small business as something going up to, like, say, 500 people, or 500 employees. But really, many of the small businesses that we think of are quite small, under 10 employees, under 2 employees, you know, solo enterprises. And, you know, unable to get the loans, denied unemployment insurance, you know, got that $1,200 payment but spent it, you know, within a couple of weeks. And, yeah, people really have no idea what they're going to do, nowhere to turn. And it is heartbreaking. It's devastating. And it is entirely too common. And, you know, back to your question that you have been asking, which is how are we going to get movement on this? I think, you know, I would encourage anyone listening to call your representatives, because this people need to hear, the elected leaders of our country need to hear what your experience is, and that there is no other option. There's no relief valve here. There are only the, you know, these supports that have been put in place and are now being removed. And, you know, we need people to be supported economically until this crisis ends. And that is going to not be a couple of weeks or a couple of months. It's actually going to be quite a long while. And we are going to have so much human suffering if we do not step in and reinstate some of the supports that are being pulled.
Melissa, what would you add? Do we still have Melissa? Melissa, are you with us? All right. Well, maybe we lost Melissa. We'll reconnect with her. I want to read a couple of emails. To your point, Terry, about PPE, Joseph has been in touch with us for many months. He runs Artisans of San Francisco. He does framing out in the Sunset District of San Francisco. And he's been talking to us about PPP and just how, you know, what that process has been like. He just emailed us again. He says, I've just seen and filled out the PPP forgiveness form from SBA 3058EZ, and it's totally screwed up. Please air this problem, and I will keep you posted as to the results with my lender. Thank you for taking an interest in small businesses that are trying to survive. Well, thank you, Joseph, and I'm sorry to hear about this. We will continue to do shows about small businesses, and please email us with updates. And actually, anyone that has issues around EDD and unemployment and small, you know, email us anytime, and we'll try to get answers and at least air it so people know, you know, what's going on, because it's so important to do that, especially those of us who can't stay home are staying home. It's just so important to stay connected. We have another email from Laura. I'm currently working from home and feel fortunate doing office work. Lately, my company is making layoff noises. I'm really scared to be laid off in the current economy and all the nightmare stories I'm hearing about how hard it is to get unemployment. I've got a friend who used to be a social worker in Marin. They say it's not hard to get if you apply online and during off times. Also, they say the problems people are having is because their eligibility is in question, whereas mine would be a straightforward layoff. My question is, do the current issues people are having apply to those with eligibility issues, or is it across the board for everyone? Terry, how would you answer that?
That might be a little too much detail for my own ability to answer, but I will try. You know, surely what we're seeing is some of that is definitely true, that there are eligibility issues. And I think, as I was saying before, that it certainly varies state by state, and that some of the eligibility restrictions are, you know, again, baked in order to discourage people from making claims. And that is something that I think it touches on a broader point that I want to make sure to mention, which is that, you know, so many of our, you know, social safety net supports are really grounded in what I would call the deservedness narrative, right? This idea that, like, well, if you're really, you know, if you're in need, we need to make sure that you're really in need and that you really deserve this help, whether it's food assistance, whether it's unemployment assistance, whether it's rent assistance. And so we have this kind of, like, guardians of the riches sort of attitude, right? Where we say, like, well, we're going to make these programs challenging to access and challenging to qualify for, because we want to make sure that you really need it. Cause, you know, somehow the notion that if you're willing to, you know, walk over a bed of glass in order to get that type of assistance. Well, then that must prove that you really are in need. And I think that's really something we need to turn on its head. And especially in this moment, it is being turned on its head. And I think many people who never before have had to ask for any kind of help are suddenly finding themselves in dire straits and are like, oh, wait, this has nothing to do with any action I ever took. This has everything to do with a global pandemic that was outside of everyone's control. And the idea that we've been creating these programs that keep people out is wrong, and has been, we have just been, you know, treating people poorly and making people feel bad about needing assistance when we should be doing quite the opposite and saying that, you know what, we have a lot of disparities in this country and a lot of baked in systemic problems that cause a lot of people to suffer. And we need to really challenge the ways that we set up programs if they're continuing to keep people down. So I would say that about unemployment. I would say that about any of the programs, that we need to be creating programs that help people and are easy to get into, and where we trust that people are actually making good decisions for themselves. We trust that people need the help that they say they need, and where we really challenge this kind of concept of like deservedness. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, exactly. I know exactly what you mean. We talked a lot about that when we were talking about the dreamers. It's the same kind of thing. Melissa, I think we have you back.
I'm here.
Okay, sorry about that. What would you add, Melissa?
I think that these challenges that around stigma and this perception of some people being deserving and undeserving really is a huge challenge that a lot of our public benefit programs have faced. And we know that when you lift those restrictions, it just becomes easier and quicker for people to access supports. We've been watching it happen with our school meal programs. A couple years back, we led an effort to help increase universal access to meals at high poverty schools in California so that families didn't have to apply for school meals if a certain percentage of families were considered low income in that district, and it's increased access to meals dramatically. And we've seen thousands of schools in California start providing universally free meals. And now with the pandemic, we're seeing the same thing. As soon as schools were able to lift these restrictions of finding out who was at 185% of the federal poverty level or below and asking kids to wise and sign in and show up to pick up meals, as soon as we lifted those restrictions, we got help out more quickly to millions of families. We were able to shorten the lines at schools for those school meal pickups. As soon as we lift those restrictions, it becomes easier for families to get the help that they need. Similarly, we've seen that with our CalFresh program. And with the pandemic, USDA wiped out some of these restrictions that would have really held up families from getting enrolled onto food assistance. And it's been a little bit of a challenge to keep some of those flexibilities in place because of this stigma around some people being deserving and others not. And I'm hopeful that a lot of Americans are seeing, oh, actually, these are benefits meant for everyone. You know, I sit here talking, and I family benefited from SNAP, CalFresh, and school meals. Millions of Californians and tons of Americans have relied on these programs, but there's just a lot of stigma out there about these programs, and people are uncomfortable about investing in supports that are meant to help people in need because of the stigma associated with these programs. And I think with so many people being forced to go to a food bank for the first time, that I think there's going to be a change and an acceptance of these programs, similarly to what we saw with the Affordable Care Act, and Americans for the first time saying, "Oh, wow, these healthcare benefits are really helpful," and you know, Medicaid isn't just for the poor, and this affordable assistance really can help people out. I think that we saw a change in public focus and recognition of healthcare coverage, and I hope we can see that with some of these food assistance programs, that these are supports meant for everyone, and that we can implement the policies and the flexibilities to help people get easy access to them continuing into the future.
Final thoughts briefly from both of you. Terry, what are your thoughts about, you know, when we might see some sort of agreement with Republicans? I mean, I watched Steve Mnuchin on the Sunday shows, and you know, now they're throwing the line that they don't want to go into debt. I mean, they're concerned about the deficit, which, you know, is so disingenuous because of that $2 trillion tax cut they passed 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think the forced austerity is just ridiculous. Like, I totally agree. You know, the federal government is, you know, can print its own money, quite literally. And economists, we organized over 150 economists that signed on to a letter, a lot of prominent economists saying, now is not the time to go small. Now is the time to go big. And part of that is sending direct cash just directly to people. Yes, unemployment. Yes, SNAP. Yes, all the other stuff. And we just need to be sending cash. People need support. They need to know that this money is coming. That level of certainty helps people make decisions, make plans. Like you were asking, Sheila, plans. It's hard to plan when you have no idea what's coming. And it also, you know, it keeps people afloat right now. And then actually we'll have a stimulative effect when the economy starts to recover. But in the meantime, we are in relief mode, and we need people to feel that relief and know that they have money coming in. And so that's why we're pushing for the direct cash payments, $1,200 a month, recurring until the economy recovers. There's a lot of support for that across bipartisan, across the political spectrum. Economists of all stripes support it, and the public supports it. So that's, I think, to your big question, like, how do we get movement on this? Like, we need to be communicating our needs to our elected leaders, tell them we need help. We need send cash. Extend unemployment, extend SNAP enhancements. Like, this is what people need, and we need it until the economy recovers so that we can stay alive, stay fed, stay housed, and then be in a position when to actually, you know, create more, to generate more economic activity as things start to pull out. But we're not there yet, and there's a long road ahead, and we are going to make it worse if we create this forced austerity, which just isn't accurate.
Terry Olea is California Campaign Director for the Economic Security Project, and Melissa Cannon is Senior Advocate at California Food Policy Advocates. Thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. A few people have written in asking how they can help Sheila Ritter. Sheila doesn't use much technology, and so I did reach out to her to find out how people can help her, and I'm sure I'll hear back from her in the next couple hours, and then I'll let you know in the coming days. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.